I've selected a reading from the Humanist Manifesto of 1933. It was precisely crafted by 34 men, yes, all were men, including distinguished Unitarian ministers of that era: Ray Bragg, John Dietrich, Lester Mondale, Clinton Lee Scott, Rhys Williams. The manifesto reads in part, "Any man who believes that he can make some God happy by making himself miserable is superstitious. Superstitious. The time has come to recognize the radical changes in religious beliefs in the modern world. The time is past for mere revision of attitudes. There is a great danger of identifying the word religion with doctrines which have lost their significance and which are powerless to solve the problems of human living. Now our understanding of the universe requires a new statement of the means and purposes of religion. The nature of the universe depicted by modern science makes unacceptable any supernatural or cosmic guarantees of human values. The time has passed for theism, deism, modernism, and varieties of new thought. Religious humanism considers the complete realization of human personality to be the end of man's life and seeks its development and fulfillment in the here and now. It follows that there will be no uniquely religious emotions and attitudes of the mind hitherto associated with belief in the supernatural. Man will learn to face crises of life in terms of his knowledge of their naturalness and probability. Reasonable and manly attitudes will be fostered by education and supported by custom. Humanism will take the path of social and mental hygiene and will discourage sentimental and unreal hopes and wishful thinking. Man is at last becoming aware that he alone is responsible for the realization of the world of his dreams, and that he has within himself the power for its achievement. He must set intelligence and will to the task." From the Humanist Manifesto of 1933. Near the Unitarian Church in Barnstable, Massachusetts, which was the first Unitarian church I ever encountered, Kurt Vonnegut lived with his family for a long time. He took his son Mark to that Sunday school. I want to begin with some words from Vonnegut's book published just before he died. It's entitled A Man Without a Country. Vonnegut writes, "My parents and grandparents were humanists, what used to be called free thinkers. We humanists try to believe as decently, as fairly, and as honorably as we can, without any expectation of rewards or punishments in an afterlife. We humanists serve as best we can the only abstraction with which we have any familiarity, which is our community. I am, incidentally, honorary president of the American Humanist Association, having succeeded the late great science fiction writer Isaac Asimov in that totally functionless capacity. We had a memorial service for Isaac a few years back. I spoke, and I said at one point, 'Isaac is up in heaven now.' Well, it was the funniest thing I could have said in an audience of humanists. I had them rolling in the aisles. It was several minutes before order could be restored. And if I should ever die, God forbid, I hope you will say, 'Kurt is up in heaven now.' That's my favorite joke." Thus writes Kurt Vonnegut. Let's turn the clock back several centuries prior to the Humanist Manifesto. There was a time when the ravages of war and conflict were overshadowed by human achievements of rare parallel. This flowering of genius found its natural home in central Italy. This is where the Renaissance flourished. During the earlier medieval era, humanity had viewed itself as feeble of will and able to act only by divine grace. But during the Renaissance, that changed. Humanity was no longer a passive inheritor of previous generations' sinfulness. We can make and remake ourselves, literally. One of Michelangelo's unfinished sculptures in Florence, some of you may have seen this. It seems to show humanity literally tearing himself out of the stone, removing the stone. Humanity can liberate itself from prisons of body, mind, and spirit. And in the centuries since the Renaissance, humanism has emerged as a cornerstone of the religious and secular landscape. 46% of Unitarian Universalists now regard themselves as humanists. Perhaps humanist hyphenated. I am a hyphenated humanist. Many of us are hyphenated, and thank goodness for that. And even those who might not self-identify as humanists appreciate those values with which humanism has shaped our UU identity. While humanism is grounded in the Renaissance, it goes way back before that, to Origen of Alexandria in the first century, Erasmus of Rotterdam, the Age of Enlightenment in the 18th century, and the philosopher Nietzsche. Just a word about Nietzsche. I've mentioned him before. He believed that our human behavior stems from a will to power. And yet Nietzsche wasn't referring to coercive, manipulative power. He was talking about self-mastery, power over the self. Power over the self. And self-mastery now, not in some state of being after death. This is the opportunity that is promised to us. Now let's build upon that foundation. The spring of 1911, over a century ago, Pittsburgh, Reverend John Dietrich, he heard Nietzsche's call, and he resigned from his Orthodox denomination and became a Unitarian minister. Some of you may have seen the article about Dietrich in the current UU World, which just arrived. Dietrich was called by the Unitarian Society in Spokane. And in 5 years' time, he grew their membership from 60 to over 1,500. He moved to First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis and again captivated crowds of well over 1,000 at his one-hour-long Sunday addresses. It required that they move downtown to the Garrick Theater. And to this day, First Unitarian in Minneapolis remains a flagship congregation of our humanist heritage. So what is humanism? My colleague John Corrado writes, "I am a religious humanist and gladly so. Religious humanism is rooted in a tradition which has blessed us all. It is rooted in the classical humanism, which was the guiding force of the Renaissance. They were scholars and poets, Dante, Erasmus, Petrarch, many others who believed in reason as well as religion. They were not secularists. No matter what televangelists may say, humanism and Christianity need not be in conflict. A Christian can be a religious humanist. So can a Jew or a Hindu or an agnostic or anyone in any religious classification. I am a humanist," and this is John Corrado, "because I believe that religion must deal with things of human concern, things of this world, right now. I believe in the free personal quest for truth and goodness. Religious humanism draws from wells which are deep." In the reading a moment ago, we heard words from the Humanist Manifesto of 1933. For just a few minutes, I want to highlight just a few central traits of this foundational source of our tradition. Number one, courage. Courage. These words by Bertrand Russell. We wish to stand on our own feet and look fair and square at the world, its good and its evil, its beauty and its ugliness. To see it as it is and not be afraid of it. To conquer the world by intelligence and not by being slavishly subdued to the terror that may come from it. We should make the best we can of the world, a world with knowledge and kindliness and courage, a fearless outlook and a free intelligence, hope for the future, which we trust will be far surpassing what our intelligence can now create. A second touchstone, uncertainty. Yes, uncertainty. These are remarks by Rabbi Sherman Wine. The age of science is an age of uncertainty. No more can eternal answers console the human heart. Religious dogma has been replaced by the humility of testing. The age of science is the age of testing, of courage, of openness. Bravery is not possible if all is predictable. Only the danger of surprise, the danger of surprise, gives us the dignity of true freedom. The danger of surprise. That's kind of a touchstone of interim ministry, in case you haven't noticed it. Both the danger and the surprise. Happiness. These remarks by Robert Ingersoll. Anyone who believes that he can make some God happy by making himself miserable is superstitious. That's Ingersoll. He goes back to the Humanist Manifesto too. Anyone who believes he can gain happiness by raising hell with his fellow men in this world is simply superstitious. He who believes that there is any other religious duty than to increase the happiness of humanity is just superstitious. Reason is the only torch, justice the only worship. Love is the only priest, and happiness is the only good. And the time to be happy is now. And the way to be happy is to help others be so. And finally, some notes on humility and doubt. And these remarks I want to continue to next week as well. Humility and doubt. Cherish your doubts, for doubt is the handmaiden of faith and of truth. Doubt is the key to the door of knowledge. It is the servant of discovery. I want to add a little footnote here about doubt. If there's no room for doubt, there's no room for me. I have sadly had to say this to some of my long-term friends who have tried to move me towards certainty. And I've had to say, if you cannot contain my doubts, it may be that you cannot contain who I am. Doubt. Let no man fear the truth or fear that doubt may consume it. Let us not fear doubt. Let us rejoice in its help to us. I note that the humanism of the 1930s did have its somewhat lighter side. One of the signers of the manifesto, Oliver Reiser, suggested what a humanist's prayer might sound like. He suggested it might be something like this. Thou cosmic movement, cosmic continuum, we petition thee to lend auditory discrimination to these, our laryngeal contractions. May our cortical pathways always keep vigilance over our lower reflexes. May our endocrines not hypertrophy, nor our hormones become toxic. increase our opsonic index, and though we walk through the valley of depressed metabolism, may we secrete no useless adrenaline. Okay, this parody, I think it was not meant to disrespect those for whom prayer genuinely is important, but I think it reflects an undeniable quality of the humanism of the 1930s, a preference for wordiness, concreteness. And at the time of the original manifestos, these represented humanists' ways to explain why things are as they are. I want to shift ahead to 1973. In that year, a Unitarian ministerial student who would later become UUA president, Bill Schultz, he was just 23, the youngest signer of Humanist Manifesto 2. Manifesto 2 came along in 1973. And here are Bill's hindsight reflections on how humanism has changed. He says, much of the original manifesto's humanism was pinched and even arrogant, and dismissive of the vast realms of human experience that could not be reached by cognition alone. This type of rationalism seemed very suitable for those unable or unwilling to journey into the interior haunts of the unconscious, of guilt, passion, and pain. But I knew from my experience that the only way to get through emotional despair was to dive right in and not pretend to bypass it, frightening though it may be. Earlier humanism seemed to think that there might be some way around it. And yet I found the world a far more bleak and lonely place than the brave words of the manifesto could allow. Because that manifesto had proclaimed confidently, man will learn to face the crises of life in terms of his knowledge of their naturalness and probability. Reasonableness and manly attitudes will be fostered and supported. Fair enough. Why not? The intellect is a worthy attribute. Unfortunately, the language of humanism overemphasized humanity's centrality and power to have dominion over the world. It focused on beliefs, and it bypassed the richness of human experience, longing, lamenting, laughter, shipwrecks, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Humanism lacked the means to acknowledge and respond to the ambiguous dimensions of life, other than in abstractions about probability and naturalness. Such confident optimism, it echoes Alexander Pope's essay on man. Whatever is right. However logical this conclusion may be from the standpoint of physics and thermodynamics and so forth, it has little to offer to those whose hearts have been broken, who have experienced tragedy or grace. It seemed a convenient self-justification for those who were already perched fairly high on the intellectual or social pyramid. How did humanism speak to those who were born on or who are now on the other side of the tracks? To be sure, the humanism of 80 years ago recognized that it too would change. And in this second manifesto of 1973, its preface declares, events since the original manifesto make that earlier statement seem far too optimistic. Nazism has shown the depths of brutality of which humanity is capable. Other totalitarian regimes have suppressed human rights without ending poverty. Science has brought us evil as well as good. Inhuman wars are made in the name of peace. We are reaching for a vision in a time that needs direction. This is a somewhat more humble and inclusive point of reference. And it goes on to address religion, ethics, the individual, democratic society, world community. In a way, it's a laundry list of so many aspirations representing a far more diverse constituency than in Manifesto 1. For Manifesto 2 reflects the sobering aftermath of Watergate and Vietnam and the civil rights era and Hiroshima and Auschwitz and on and on. The optimism of onward and upward has been tempered. Manifesto 3 came after 9/11. Another shaking of the foundations. And next week, we'll continue to look at how humanism has evolved. And I can't help but speculate and wonder, might there be a Manifesto 4? I almost don't like the word manifesto. It's too strident. But something that will reframe the landscapes. Is the changing of the world in our very midst sufficient to warrant such a reframing of humanism at its best? I want to close with the words of a pioneer humanist, Reverend Roger Greeley, who was formerly minister in Kalamazoo, where I served as interim. Greeley's affirmation embodies both conviction and generosity. And with these words, I'll close. To make decisions in the light of evidence, to hold fast to the central purpose for our being, to seek solutions to the problems confronting us, to face together the facts no matter how cruel or frustrating, to seek resolutely the realization of self through service to others, to grow together in fellowship, to go forth in pursuit of the ideal, to hold on to the dream and dispel the nightmare, and above all, to be true to wisdom and remain compassionate. This is our aspiration. Reverend Roger Greeley.